What is up, Brad fans? How you doing? How you living? Welcome to the latest episode. In this episode, no interview today, this time around, but I'm going to be talking about two news stories that came across my desk this month and that are, to me, very interesting. One of them, you've probably heard about and might be giving you a little bit of stress, and that is the H5N1 outbreak in dairy cows. This avian influenza that has now gone into dairy cows in the US and appears to be spreading there. We're going to talk about why that's unnerving. And we're going to, of course, talk about the thing that seems to be on everyone's mind and why a lot of mainstream outlets have picked this up. And that is the food supply. Is the milk safe? We all want to know. The second story is totally unrelated, a bit more fun, a bit more maybe interesting. And that is a really cool study that was done in mice with MDMA, looking at the question, does MDMA, the psychedelic party drug, increase empathy? And the reason people are asking this is because MDMA will soon become the first so-called psychedelic that will be approved for use in therapy. But as you know from this show, we don't really know a lot about how these things work and how they can enhance therapy. There's a lot of theories, one of them with MDMA being that an increase in empathy is going to, you know, improve the therapy. Just very general, high level explanation. But nobody really knows if MDMA increases empathy. So this group decided to test this out in mice, and we're going to break that one down for you as well. How the experiments work, why do this in mice, and what they found. And what they found is really, really interesting. So stay tuned for that. Before we get into it, the usual announcements. Subscribe, rate, comment, review, all of those things really, really, really help us out. It's probably the best thing you can do for the show to increase visibility. That, and also just tell your friends. If you think this show is worth something, let people know. Check out the links in the show notes for all the links to the studies and articles that we talk about in the show, but also to how to get to our homepage, that kind of thing, where you can chip in a few bucks if you want. But you can also share the show, follow, subscribe there. Everything is all there. You can also follow us on Instagram at @2Brad4You. We are on X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, at @2Brad4You as well. Less active there than on Instagram, but do give us a follow. And again, the links for everything will be on those pages. So just at @2Brad4You, anywhere you want to go, and you'll find those links. Finally, announcement. I'm going to branch out into YouTube. I've been thinking about this for a while, and I think I can do it. I think I can find a streamlined way where we can just have videos that complement the podcast or sections of the podcast put up on YouTube, so you can get sort of shorter bites of information. And I'm going to start trying to produce YouTube exclusive content as well. So we are going to be on YouTube, @2Brad4You. Watch for that in the coming weeks. If you're following us on Instagram and social media, you'll get updates as to when those are coming out as well. So thank you all so much for supporting the show, supporting, you know, the growth of this show by liking, commenting, subscribing, all of that stuff, reviewing. It's given me the push to branch out and try new things, YouTube being one of them. And hopefully we can get some ideas generated from you as well. You know, send your ideas to me for some YouTube exclusive content. All right. That's enough of the announcements. Let's get into the meat of it. We're going to talk about avian influenza moving into cows. Who cares? Why you should care? What are we going to do about it? Is the milk safe? And then, if that didn't hit you enough emotionally, MDMA, will it increase your empathy? Even if you've been attempting to avoid all virus-related, pandemic-related, outbreak-related news in the last little while, you've likely heard about the situation of H5N1 avian influenza infecting dairy cows in the US. So the story's starting to get mainstream attention, which is good, but it's actually been developing for several years now. The two big concerns we have when talking about an outbreak of avian influenza in dairy cows is, of course, the food supply, but also the potential for the virus to mutate further and become a version that is easy to spread among humans and infect humans, at which point we could have another outbreak on our hands. So H5N1 is not a new strain of flu, not a new type of flu. Scientists actually isolated this one back in the mid-90s. And since about the early 2000s, it's infected about 870, maybe 900 people, of which about 450, 470 of those have died, meaning there's a case fatality rate of about 50%, which is high, but it's possible that there's a lot of milder cases that go unreported and therefore they don't show up in the stats. So that number could come down. But the concerning developments with H5N1 really started back in about 2022. Just as sort of COVID was ending for a lot of us, this strain, this type of flu really exploded in bird populations, so wild birds and domestic birds. And it's killed millions of birds, again, wild and domestic, all over the world. And it's also forced the culling of a lot of domestic birds, chickens mostly, to prevent the spread of this virus. So lots and lots of birds have been taken out by this virus. And we're also seeing this disturbing trend of more and more mammals becoming infected, which is going to lead us to dairy cows. But in 2019, for example, 10 countries reported mammals infected with the H5N1 virus. Since 2020 and 2024, 40 new mammalian species have been reported, and the number of countries reporting those infections has jumped to 26. So this shows that the virus is not only expanding its range in terms of species that it can infect, but also geographically, which is generally not a good situation when you're talking about an infectious disease. And my audience likely knows that as more mammals get infected, this is just going to increase the chances that the virus mutates and becomes more compatible to humans, meaning we can get it from animals and then pass it to each other. And that will be, again, bad news for all of us that have already gone through one pandemic situation. So this brings us to cows. So right now, the risk of this virus, whether it's coming from birds or the version that is now in cows, is really about people that work with those animals or who are around those animals. And then, of course, there is concerns about the food supply, which we will get to. And again, this comes down to containing the infection in dairy cows, because we now have a situation where it looks like the outbreak in dairy cows is much bigger than what we can actually confirm right now. There's some data that suggests that with more testing, we would find a lot more cases. And so this creates a situation where you have the virus circulating amongst the mammal in close quarters. It can transmit a lot. It can spread with the movement of cows because, you know, the dairy industry, the cattle industry is going to move cows around a lot. This provides a lot of opportunity for mutation, but it also puts it into contact with people. So that chance for spread across species is there. And in fact, the first ever case of H5N1 in a human coming from a cow has occurred in Texas. That person, that dairy worker, was okay. They only had a mild infection, and they don't appear to have spread it to anyone else. But this shows you the concerning situation that we have. And in an article in Science News, several researchers, infectious disease experts, veterinarians quoted, really putting forward the point, saying what we're doing right now in terms of containment and testing is a drop in the bucket. I believe that was the exact quote, a drop in the bucket. These articles will all be linked in the description in the show notes, so you can check them out. So testing, in their opinion, needs to increase, but also the restrictions that are going into place. So there was an order put in that all dairy cows moving across state lines needed to be tested. And then they changed that to 30 animals in a group that's moving needed to be tested. So of course, from the expert side, from the infectious disease people side, there's always going to be this, we need to do more, we need to do more. I would agree with them in this situation. And we're already seeing neighboring countries in the to the US, Canada and Mexico, starting to put in testing requirements for dairy cows that are moving across the borders. So the situation is a bit tense right now because you have a lot of animals to test. We don't really know the scope of the outbreak in there, but you also have these sort of tensions between industry and government. Obviously, it's not a good look for private dairy farms to have a disease on their farm. So human nature sometimes tends to be to want to ignore this or not admit that you have it, which is obviously not a good situation. So the experts are calling for a lot more work to be done in terms of testing and restrictions. And if you were around in the 90s, I was a child in the 90s, there was a situation of mad cow disease in the UK, which you could argue, you could make an argument, the risk for getting mad cow from the meat supply is kind of low, but it was high enough that they killed a lot of animals. Like a lot of animals were just culled in order to try and stop this outbreak. And it's a very different disease than flu, but that caused a huge amount of chaos, economic losses, big situation in the UK. And that's kind of the tension that people are dealing with right now in terms of identifying the outbreak in cows and then trying to contain it. Obviously, you don't want it to spread from dairy cows to beef cows. There's some crossing there that you want to contain. But the big thing, too, is wanting to prevent an outbreak in pigs, swine. So agricultural products, agricultural animals tend to have these moments where they're going to be able to mix, or the virus will be able to jump between them. And pigs are actually physiologically, genetically more similar to humans, let's say. So a virus that gets into pigs is easier to transmit generally to a human than it would be from a cow to a human. So if you get a big outbreak like this, that like what we're seeing in the dairy cows in the swine population, that's a really, really, really good place for a virus to mix and match and become better suitable to infect humans. So that's something that we really, really want to avoid. You've probably heard headlines in the past about swine flus and like them also being a concern for infectious disease researchers, all that. So that's really what the situation is about right now, is really preventing containment or preventing spread and containment. And in order to do that, as we all know now from our COVID experience, testing, movement restrictions of these animals, really making sure that there's not a lot of places where the virus can jump into new herds and also new species. Like I said, especially pigs. So what about the milk? This brings us to the food supply. And at first glance, it might seem like not a good situation, but there's actually some better news here than the news regarding the size of the outbreak in dairy cows. First off, it does look like the virus, the H5N1 virus, likes to be in the milk-producing tissue of cows. So there's a lot of virus concentrated in those cells, and it is getting into milk. They tested a bunch of cats on dairy farms that died. Many of them died from the H5N1. And the strain that these cats had was very similar to the cow one, indicating that they likely got the infection from drinking milk or they got it from the cows rather than, you know, eating a dead bird or something like that. So there's evidence that it can be in milk and that it can infect through there. Thankfully, milk is pasteurized. Pasteurized is, of course, a sterilization process where you heat things up really, really high, and it kills pathogens, including viruses. So there's been a bunch of testing done on pasteurized milk, you know, commercial milk supply. And while they found virus particles in that milk, when they took those samples and then tried to grow the virus in living cells or in chicken embryos, something like this, it didn't work. So it shows that the virus is inactivated. It is dead in those milk samples. And so there's no risk for infection from consuming that. They want to test a few other products, according to the article in Science, just to really understand how safe everything is and how widespread everything is. They've done some testing in ground beef and haven't found anything there. So there's really no reason to believe that pasteurization wouldn't inactivate the virus. Now, yes, this is the first time that H5N1 has been in dairy cows. And so it's never gone through pasteurized, like it's never been tested officially with pasteurization. But pasteurization is known to kill many, 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 many other similar viruses, so-called RNA viruses that influenza A, H5N1 is. So there's really no reason to think that it wouldn't work. And now some of these tests are in fact confirming that. So unless you're drinking raw milk, which at the moment is considered a risk, you should be fine. And raw milk, I know a lot of people drink that. I'm not so sure why. I mean, maybe it tastes better. I don't know, but I haven't seen any evidence for like the benefits of it outweighing the risks of it. Because whether it's not just H5N1, it's not just flu. I mean, milk can be filled with lots of pathogens, bacteria especially, and pasteurization is, you know, we do that for a reason, to sterilize, you know, the food that we eat, just like when you cook your food. Now, I know people eat a lot of raw food because it tastes good and stuff. So I guess I don't really want to condemn people for drinking raw milk, but I just never really understood that one. And I know there's a lot of like natural people that talk about the health benefits and stuff like this, but I don't know. So raw milk is considered a risk right now. Pasteurized milk is safe. If you're cooking your beef to the safe temperature, there really shouldn't be any concern about the food supply. So that is the good news right now. So again, food supply looks good. There shouldn't be any problems there. We're really talking about containing this virus so that it doesn't spread to more cattle, more places, and especially to more mammals. And that's going to be really difficult to do, as we've all, again, learned from our COVID experience. Containing a virus is next to impossible. So it's really about like slowing it down and making sure that we have eyes on it so that we can really be prepared for what's coming. And there was a great article, which again, I will link to in the show notes, from a publication that I highly recommend if you want to get sort of non-mainstream news about diseases and health and science, called MedPage Today. It's a page that it's a website that is news for doctors, often written by doctors, and really specialized health and medical journalists. But you can still read it and understand it. It's a great source for lots of you know, medical and health news. And there was a piece there written by an infectious disease physician, so a specialist, someone who really knows what's going on. And the point they made was, this is not a test run. This is not something where we say, oh, like, let's see how our systems work and we'll test it for the big one, the next big one. She says, no, this is a warning shot. This should be taken as a warning shot that we need to act now to prevent further spread rather than deal with a larger situation later. So that's the latest on the H5N1. We're going to keep tracking this. I'm sure you're going to see more of it in the mainstream news. But for now, let's switch over to a topic that we're all a little more comfortable with on this show, and that is psychedelics. MDMA, super fun party drug, now therapy tool for PTSD. If you followed this channel or my podcast for any length of time, you'll have heard me talk about psychedelics and their potential as really adjunct for therapy. So things that can enhance the effects of therapy. And MDMA looks like it's going to be the first one that gets official approval from the FDA in the US. And that means that doctors are going to be able to prescribe it. And along with that comes the possibility that these things will be used off-label. MDMA could even be used off-label, which basically just means it's not being used for the exact thing that it's been approved for, but doctors can make a judgment call and prescribe it in a what we call an off-label way. So this brings about a lot of questions as to, well, how does MDMA work in therapy, and what should we be reasonably prescribing it for if we are going to open it up to this off-label characterization? And the answer is really that we don't really know how any of these psychedelics, let's say, quote unquote, work when it comes to how they have their therapeutic benefits. Very broadly, what we see is that in trials, patients that undergo talk therapy, normal therapy, usually it's of the cognitive behavioral type, and then they have a session of MDMA, sometimes psilocybin, and then they undergo more therapy. The long-lasting effects of that therapy are greater than if they had just done therapy alone. So people report less distressful symptoms for a longer period of time than with just therapy alone. But nobody really knows why that is. And it's really, really hard to tease these things out. Again, if you've listened to some of the previous podcasts I've done on this, you'll know that it's the human mind is very subjective, and there's a lot of subjectivity that goes into a psychedelic experience, things we call set and setting, right? Like these drugs will impact people in a very different way. So we can understand a little bit about what's going on in the brain, the chemicals that are being released or inhibited, these kind of things. But we don't really understand why that leads to behaviors or feelings or emotions. And with MDMA, there's a theory that it is what we call an pathogen, meaning it enhances empathy. And there's been some rodent studies that look at this question, and there's been some human studies that look at this question. And in the human studies, it's really difficult to kind of tease out. There's conflicting results. And it's possible that, again, it's just going from a sort of mechanistic view of what's happening in the brain to outcomes like emotions and empathy is very difficult to sort of follow in an experimental way in humans. And it's also possible that just our experimental setups just aren't that good for teasing these things out. And this is why people turn to animal models. So like I said, some rodent models. And there was a really, really interesting paper out that has done some really cool work to show that, yeah, it looks like MDMA might actually enhance empathy in mice. And this is, you know, one of the theories as to why it might work as a therapeutic when it comes to enhancing therapy. There's more of an empathetic connection with the patient to the therapist, or just to their surroundings. They're more open to empathy, and this might, you know, increase the value of the therapy that they're receiving. But again, we can't really prove so far that the MDMA actually enhances empathy in humans, so we turn to mice. So with any work where you're using a model system, whether it's like a mouse model or even some plant models and stuff, the benefits of this is that you can strip away a lot of confounding factors. That's the goal, is that we're trying to get down to one or two questions that we can control all the other variables and just look at what happens when we manipulate these one or two things. So they're never perfect proxies for what's going on in humans, but they offer some very interesting insights. And in this case, we're looking at empathy-like behaviors, and specifically a paradigm of experiments where we look at the social transfer of some kind of what we would call like an emotion or a feeling, in this case, pain. So this has been well established in a lot of previous studies that if you have two animals, two rodents, let's say, two mice, one of them experiences some kind of pain while the other one does not, but yet they're interacting together for a given period of time, the one that doesn't actually experience the pain doesn't actually get the case of the experiment we're going to talk about today, it was a small injection to create inflammation and some pain and soreness in one of the paws. The animal that doesn't actually receive that stimulus will behave as though it did. So it will kind of mimic these behaviors of its friend, of its partner that's actually experiencing this negative emotion. And you can do it with a positive emotion as well. And it's called this emotional transfer or social transfer of emotion. These are the kind of terms that get thrown around in the papers. And it's meant to be like a proxy for empathy. If an animal can understand that the other animal is feeling this way, and then it sort of mimics it, it sort of behaves in a similar way, then we use that as a proxy for, yes, there's some kind of empathy going down. So again, not perfect, but it's a really well-established experimental setup that you can do, and then you can test all of these different things to see whether that effect of the social transfer of the emotion is increased or decreased. And in this case, they did it with MDMA. And lo and behold, yes, MDMA seemed to increase the amount of time and the strength of the sort of transfer of the emotion. So you have two animals put together. One receives the inflammatory injection into, you know, I don't know exactly which paw, but let's say, you know, back left. The other animal then interacts with that animal for, I think it was 10 minutes, and then you separate them, and with a small brush, check the sensitivity of that back left paw that had received the injection, and then the same on the animal that didn't receive the injection. And the animal that didn't receive the injection will kind of show sensitivity as though it had been experiencing pain in that paw. And when an animal is on MDMA and then interacts with a partner who has had the injection, that sensitivity will be pretty pronounced and last for about 24 hours, which is more than it would if it hadn't gotten the MDMA. So that's a really interesting finding right there. And it shows that, yes, MDMA enhances this empathy-like behavior, this social transfer of pain. They had another setup where they did the same thing, but then they give the animal an analgesic, so something to remove the pain during the interaction. And you see that, again, this positive, we'll say, feeling of having the pain removed, the animals will again mimic that. So that positive feeling gets transferred as well, although not as long, it's not as strong as the negative emotion, the pain. But it looks like MDMA is, yes, it's enhancing empathy or empathy-like behaviors in these mice. So then they wanted to go a couple steps further and isolate where in the brain this might be going on. And there's been a lot of other studies that show where MDMA sort of localizes in the brain, where it does a lot of its effects. And that's in a place called the nucleus accumbens. So rather than give the mice the MDMA just as an injection into the whole system, they injected it directly into that area of the brain and found, again, the effects persist. So it's a good indication that this is the brain region where the mechanism is at play, where things are happening that's leading to this increase in empathy. You can then also look at what sort of neurotransmitters are going on, and it's serotonin is the main one. No surprise there. A lot of these sorts of drugs, the sort of classic psychedelics, act on the serotonin system. And they followed this up with a really, really neat experiment using a model of mice that have autism spectrum disorder. So autism spectrum disorder is characterized by lack of empathy, lack of sociality, these kind of things. People with autism generally can't relate to people without autism as easily. They lack the ability to sort of pick up on these social cues. And so the idea is that like empathy is one of these things. And so again, you can get model systems with mice that have been genetically modified so that they display these autism-like behaviors. And if you give them MDMA, they're more social than they otherwise would be. And so using this same model, they looked at whether the effects of the social transfer, of the empathy increase, would again occur. And it did. The MDMA, you know, in these autism-like mice increased that social transfer, increased that empathy. So again, another really interesting finding and another brick in the wall, let's say, of MDMA is enhancing empathy. They also did some experiments where rather than MDMA, you just increase the serotonin, the specific serotonin neurotransmitter that's being activated. And that also appeared to do this. So it's really narrowing in on the what we call the mechanism of this action of how MDMA enhances empathy. And it all tells this really nice story about, yes, MDMA might be this empathy enhancing thing that we think it is. And once you have more evidence in that area, you can start to then extrapolate on the theories for humans, what might be good uses for this. If we think that, you know, it is this, you know, increase in empathy that's going on, how might we be ever better able to use this, to tailor this towards therapy and other sort of therapeutic outcomes? One really, really interesting thing that stood out to me, and the authors of the experiments of the scientific paper have no explanation for, is the effects were only seen in male mice. So if you give female mice MDMA, there's not this same increase in the empathy-like behaviors, in the emotional transfer, which is really, really interesting. And they don't really have an idea why. Both males and females without MDMA show the same level of the transfer of the social emotional transfer, but the effects of MDMA only occur really in the male mice. And there's some anecdotal evidence as well in humans that MDMA increases, you know, pro-social effects in men more than it does in women, whereas in women, they tend to report more, let's say, hallucinatory or like visual, sensory kind of effects. And there's also more adverse effects in women. And it's not really clear why that would be, you know, pharmacologically. Why would that happen? It's not like there's that big, there's no real difference between men and women when it comes to how these drugs act on our system. But it's just a really neat finding and something that would be really cool to explore more. But yeah, turns out MDMA works best for increasing empathy in male mice and doesn't work in female mice. So I think this is a really cool study because it shows how you have to blend, you know, these sort of mechanistic studies, what is physically happening in the brain with, you know, this other side of the research, which is the therapy, which is, you know, using these things that we don't completely understand how they work in the brain, what their effects are, what they're doing, to increase our benefits from therapy. And there's sort of this age-old conundrum in science where we talk about whether things are predictive. So if we know if we do something, we're going to get the outcome that we want, or whether they're explanatory, we can explain why that is. And there's different experiments that are set up to sort of do the two things, the predictive side or the explanatory side. And there's always this debate or discussion about what is the true value of something. If you look at something from the medical side, you know, being able to predict disease or being able to predict that this is going to help you feel better is very valuable. But without that understanding as to why, you might lose sight of other uses for that thing, or you might lose sight of potential harms and side effects. So you really need both happening at one time. And as I mentioned at the top, you know, teasing out how therapy works, how these drugs, which are so subjective, they create very different experiences for each individual. We just talked about how men and women experience things very differently under these drugs. You know, teasing out all of these factors is very almost impossible, it seems, at this point. And I like to think of it more as it's not one or the other. It's not teasing them apart, really, more as just understanding how they're knotted together and how you can make the tightest knot, which, you know, the metaphor being the tight knot being the best outcomes for therapy. So how does someone's background, how does someone's environment, how does someone's physiology, their genetics, like all of this stuff, coupled with a drug, coupled with talk therapy, coupled with a different kind of therapy, you know, how are all of these things going to work together to, you know, get the best outcome? Part of understanding that is going to be understanding how they work in the brain. So this is a nice step towards that. Really, really cool study. And it's going to, you know, pave the way for more stuff. And it's going to be really, really interesting to see when MDMA does get approved, what types of experiments come next, and what types of conditions or scenarios doctors, psychiatrists are going to use MDMA, given, you know, the results of experiments like this, and many more to come. So as we've said, every time we talk about psychedelics on this show, there's so much that we still don't understand in this weird gray area of the mind and, you know, neurotransmitters and emotions, which is what makes it super, super fascinating, but also makes it feel like every time we get a step forward, we have more questions and maybe even less understanding of what's actually going on. But really, really fascinating one to watch, and we'll continue to watch this one and, of course, bring updates on how the trials are progressing through the FDA approval process. Like I said, It appears as though approval for MDMA as a therapeutic, an adjunct to therapy for PTSD, is imminent. Thank you all so very much for listening. I hope you found that interesting. As always, check the show notes for all of the links to articles and scientific papers that we talk about in this. You'll get a lot more information there. If you have questions about anything you've heard on the show, please reach out at TooBradForYou on X and Instagram. You'll also find links there to get to our homepage, landing page, where you can subscribe, rate, review, comment, all that kind of great stuff. But please do reach out if you have any questions at all, you need further clarification on something. I'd be happy to correspond with you. We also have an email, toobradforyou@gmail.com. That's it. That's all. Watch for YouTube videos coming soon. Thank you again. Tell your friends about the show if you think it's worth it, and you're a listener, then hey, maybe you have a friend that might be too. Thanks so much, everybody. Take care. Until next time, bye for now.